This is Gordon Evans. I am speaking with Nancy Love. She's a professor of government and justice studies at Appalachian State University. She will deliver the annual Samuel Clark Lecture Thursday, which is sponsored by Western Michigan University's Political Science Department. It's called Hate Music, Political Violence, and Democratic Politics. Nancy Love, thank you very much for taking some time to speak with us.
Thank you for inviting me to do so.
Let's start off with that title. What exactly are you getting at with the idea of hate music, political violence, and democratic politics?
Well, I'm particularly interested in the tone of our politics today. And in terms of hate music, I am focused specifically on right-wing extremist music, music that is targeting particular groups as an other, and music that specifically advocates violence against those groups.
Now, some of our audience may hear that and think that they really are not very familiar with that sort of music. That doesn't seem like something they've heard. How prevalent is it? How widespread and how listened to is music which you might classify as hate music?
Well, surprisingly widespread. There are several genres. There is white power rock, which is racist skinhead music and also includes some heavy metal music. There's also neo-Nazi folk music, and then some country music, which is emphasizing white racial pride and identity, would be included. But maybe more important for listeners to know is that there are 350 active bands in the U.S., Western Europe, and post-communist nations, and 100 to 150 of those bands are based in the United States. And the white power music industry today is a multi-million dollar global industry, major source of funding for what is for many citizens an underground movement, but that gives these activists some of the cover that they need to be able to mobilize and organize supporters.
Now, when you mention underground movement, are people perhaps hearing this music in ways that they couldn't have heard it 30 years ago? In other words, maybe not through mainstream radio stations, but through internet websites and those sort of things.
Yes, and that is also part of a shift in tactics on the part of the radical right. There's an increasing focus on organizing internationally via the internet and forming alliances between neo-Nazi, white supremacist, and Christian identity organizations. But to speak specifically to your question, these groups have long organized in what have been called hidden spaces, private clubs, restricted festivals, through specific record companies with their own fanzines that were known by supporters of the movement. They're now increasingly present on the internet through YouTube videos. So we have image, lyrics, message, and sound available. And they're also available through mainstream distributors, which some listeners may not be aware of. Much of the music that I'll be speaking about can be purchased, for example, over Amazon.
Are there people who, as fans or listeners, are going to be more susceptible to the message and perhaps maybe listen to the lyrics and say, that rings true to me, and this band says something to me that that I believe and that I should act on?
The movement is specifically targeting certain populations through music, with an emphasis, not surprisingly, on teenagers as part of a process of adolescent identity formation and also sort of acting out of anger, resistance toward authority. That's one of, I think, the more troubling aspects of the music. I think, though more important, there's been a general increase in hate group membership and specifically membership in patriot and militia groups since the 2008 election of President Barack Obama. And the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks these organizations, has argued that they're mobilizing new support due to anger against rising public debt, changing demographics, declining economic options, and then a number of initiatives of the Obama presidency that have been, I would argue, misperceived as socialist or some claim even fascist.
You mentioned that it's not just the United States, but there's other countries where these bands find an audience. Can we say that there are countries where it is more prevalent, perhaps a greater percentage of the population seems to take an interest in these bands and what they have to say?
The white power music genre really began in Britain in the late 1970s. I think that's important. The founding band and its lead singer, the band Screwdriver, and lead singer Ian Stuart Donaldson. And the movement came out of white working class punk, which split into a right and a left. The left engaged actively in Rock Against Racism. The Clash was a major band associated with that. And then the right involved in a Rock Against Communism initiative. And Screwdriver's music moved from Britain to France and to Germany and then to the United States. It really was the catalyst for the wider movement, and story after story of members who were recruited to white supremacy and in some cases later left the movement through music point to Screwdriver as the band that got them involved.
And in part, I believe I read a paper of yours on this, that the lead singer was a very charismatic gentleman. I think a member of the band said that if you sat down and talked to him for 15 minutes, he could persuade you that he was right, or at least that he had a point of view that you should listen to. Is that something that runs through some of these bands as a charisma or a personal quality about members of the band, perhaps the lead singer, that makes the message come across better?
I think it is. Often the lead singers are positioned and marketed as spokespeople and heroes of the movement. And one thing that distinguishes some racist skinhead music from other sort of punk rock music is that the lyrics are intelligible. So the lead singers are communicating a message to their audience via music. And the lyrics and the sounds often work together to create a sense of group identity, a sense of belonging, and to fire people up on behalf of the movement.
Is there anything similar on the left? You've talked a lot about the right-wing bands. Is there anything similar on the left to speak of in 2014?
I don't think there is a similarly unified and organized movement on the left using music to recruit today. But that said, there's a very long history of protest music from progressive movements. And my last book, Musical Democracy, focused on the use of music to mobilize by civil rights activists and feminist activists. I would also add the environmental movement and longer history, the labor movement, and peace movements. Those tend to be more folk-oriented. And I need to mention the recent death of Pete Seeger, a founding father of progressive folk music revival in American politics on behalf of all of those movements, really of fusion music. What's interesting to me is that Occupy doesn't yet have, to the best of my knowledge, its music. And if we're going to look for where it would emerge from the left, from progressive movements, I would point toward Occupy. I think that may still happen.
If we're concerned about the message that these skinhead bands are disseminating and how it's being received, what do we do about it in a society like the United States, where we treasure the First Amendment right to freedom of speech and of people to say or sing things which, while we might find objectionable, we still think that they have the right to express themselves?
That's a really important question. I am careful not to argue for censorship of this music, because I do respect First Amendment rights and freedom of political, artistic, and in some cases, these groups also claim religious expression. I think that an attempt to censor might only drive the music underground again into hidden spaces. That said, my concern is that because of First Amendment protections, these groups are able to record and distribute from the United States more freely than from some other Western democracies. And so in that context, I think it's really important to educate. My intention in presenting material about these groups and their music is certainly not in any way to disseminate or valorize what they're doing, but to let people know how readily available this music is, with the intention of making people aware so that they can counter its harmful messages and, among other things, educate the teenagers who are specifically being targeted by the music.
Is the other side of that question of technology and the music being available, is it also the case that it's easier for people who have concerns about it to know that it exists? You mentioned the idea that it could be underground or in hidden spaces. Is it tough to hide in this day and age if you have music out there and people are listening to it in one form or another?
If you know to look, it's easy to find, and that does also make it easy to counter. And in this context, I would want to mention an organization, Life After Hate, which was founded with the specific purpose of providing information and resources to communities that are organizing and advocating against hate. The organization is composed of former members of white supremacist groups, many of whom were drawn into the movement through music. And so they are a really important resource for communities that are trying to educate and work against hate.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap it up?
The only other thing I might mention is that I talked some about the lyrics and the message, that the lyrics and the music work together, and there is a growing literature that does discuss how individuals can be primed by aggressive lyrics, images, and sounds to aggressive thoughts, perceptions, and possibly even behaviors. So it's the entire music scene that is cause for concern, not just the message in the lyrics. And the music gives that message additional power.
Professor Love, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Nancy Love is a professor of government and justice studies at Appalachian State University. She will speak Thursday night at 7 o'clock at Western Michigan University's Fetzer Center.